It's the Book of English Magic, Philip Carr Gumm, Chief Druid, but an author of many books having to do with both the spiritual side of life and with druidism, with magic, with wisdom. And we've really explored it from a couple different angles already. I think you've gotten a good feel of what the Book of English Magic is all about. But there's a point to be made that England is not just something which as a landscape has shaped magic, but magic has shaped England. And there are lots of different examples of how magic has gotten used in the history of England. We touched on it briefly before. We were talking about the Queen of England having a magician. We know all about Merlin. What are some of the other prominent magicians of England? Next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. So England itself, both the government and society, has been formed and shaped by its relationship to English magic over the years. What would you think are the best examples of that, Philip?
Well, I think I mentioned earlier John Dee, who was Queen Elizabeth's astrologer. He was asked to calculate the most auspicious time for her to be crowned, for instance. But there are many others as well. And there's a chap, for instance, called Elias Ashmole, who founded the wonderful Ashmolean Museum in Oxford, and we have the record, he was one of the first people to be, whose record of being initiated into Freemasonry is recorded, and he was a great collector and wrote a great deal about magic and so on. Because Isaac Newton, for instance, Sir Isaac Newton, who everybody knows, he was interested in alchemy. You have Sir Francis Bacon, who played a key role in the development of the scientific method, who was fascinated by magic. And, you know, it's a long list.
Yeah, and magic in this case, though, again, going back to the list you had last hour, the different types of magic, there are, I would argue, you tell me, jump in wherever you think this is wrong, that even the formation of the English language itself was a kind of magic, that that you had various forms. You had Angles. You had Saxons. You had Norse. You had French. You had Latin. You had, and to create a single language out of all of these influences that galvanized a people. It created a communication within a fairly short period of time that we still have with us today. I mean, the fact that Shakespeare wrote in English. It didn't happen that long after the language itself was codified. And here we still have the works of that guy to this day. And I think stuff like that is, to me, that's kind of magical even.
Absolutely. And of course, with Shakespeare came a whole lot of new words into the language. And there are all sorts of wonderful theories about the magic within Shakespeare. And, you know, there are people who write about that and who see the work of Shakespeare perhaps actually being the work of somebody else like Sir Francis Bacon, who was a great magician, and actually encoding all sorts of magical ideas within the Shakespeare plays.
Tell me about that a little bit more. What do you mean by that?
Well, the fact that, you know, the most visited place in – one of the most visited places, I think after Stonehenge is the most visited place by tourists in England. Second most visited place is the birthplace of Shakespeare. But in fact, we know so little about the man Shakespeare, and there are so many flaws in his biography that it seems quite likely actually he was a front man for somebody else. And that somebody else may, well, there are various cases for different people who he might have been. One of the strongest cases is for Sir Francis Bacon, who was so close to the court and so close to the Queen. It was dangerous for him to be writing plays that had various political agendas and so on. So he used Shakespeare as a front man to author the plays. And
William Shakespeare being then a real historical figure, not a pseudonym, but a real person, but somebody with whom there was an arrangement, you know, a sort of. That he was kind of a franchise of Sir Francis Bacon.
A deal. I mean, that happens today, doesn't it? You know, I mean, people write books and they get somebody else's name on the cover and they have a deal. And that was the suggestion. I mean, when tourists go to visit the tomb of Shakespeare, they see a man with a beard and a quill, you know, writing in a book like that. But it wasn't until, I can't remember, I think the 18th or possibly even the 19th century, that the actual statue was removed, which was of Shakespeare as a farmer, as a local farmer, as he was, with a couple of sacks of grain and a chubby man. And that didn't fit the image.
How interesting. I never knew that.
Only went to grammar school. He didn't. You know, when you read the Shakespeare plays, it's full of a kind of understanding of the court and the way the diplomacy and your experiences in Europe and so on. And the guy Shakespeare didn't even finish his, you know, he just went to grammar school.
Yeah, but there's lots of geniuses out there who are all, you know, autodidacts and quick studies and intuitive. I mean, the fact that he could have picked up something that he was never a part of, that doesn't surprise me as much as the fat farmer thing. That one, I wasn't expecting that. But then, you know, even up until modern times, I really love the fact that the story of that guy, Jasper Maskelyne, does that name mean anything to you?
No.
He's the magician who was actually hired by the British armed forces to deceive the Nazis during World War II with these, like he created a fake Alexandria so that the Nazis ended up bombing into the desert harmlessly by putting...
Okay.
And then he would like create these big holes where it looked like to the Nazi photographers an area that they had already bombed, but it actually had never been bombed. But they were these fake holes that he created that you would see from the sky. He hid the Suez Canal. That's just amazing to me, and I love the fact that England thought of that. That's associated with that same type of openness to magical thinking.
Absolutely. And if you look at the connection between magic and power and the government and the military and so on, one of the key features, one of the reasons why the magician is such an interesting character is he combines various roles. You know, on the one hand, he's a priest. On the other hand, he's a scientist and a doctor and an artist and a political advisor. And you see that strand of the magician as political advisor running right the way through. So you look back at, say, the stories of the Druids and Boadicea, you know, Boudicca, who was this Iceni queen who rebelled against the Romans.
Right.
She had her Druid magician who, when they were due to attack, I think it was London, he did an oracle and he let a hair out of his... cloak, and he said, look, if it goes to the left, we'll win. If it goes to the right, we'll lose, or whatever. They went in the right direction. Everybody cheered, and they attacked, and they were successful. You have the political advisor there. And then you see that going right the way through to, say, John Dee advising Queen Elizabeth I, and then right the way through to even today, our modern politicians, and Tony Blair, now the politicians, it's their wives that they affect. Do you remember the whole business with Ronald Reagan and the astrologer who...
Right.
And Nancy, right. And then
sure.
With Clinton, there was, you know, what's her name, that lovely lady who was an advisor to him until it all broke.
I blocked her out of my mind. But I remember the Reagan story quite well.
Yes, that's right. And then Tony Blair, there was a whole thing about a New Age kind of advisor who used to advise Cherie Blair and all the rest of it. So this idea is very common. Rasputin, of course. We know Rasputin
sure.
is a czar, you know, in Russia.
Well, I think everybody wants their Merlin, don't they?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
that remains sort of the, or even, again, you know, you could go back to, you know, there are some examples of that in the Bible itself. But I think that it's an ancient idea of being able to call on that. But also that we don't know quite. I mean, well, maybe you know. Has it been confirmed 100% that there really was a Merlin, or is Merlin merely an archetype?
Well, he's both. I think you know there are various suggestions of, you know, historical references to where he might have arisen from. He's certainly an archetype, as you say. Everybody wants their Merlin. I mean, we would all love, I think, to have a wise old man or a wise old woman who we could turn to in times of stress and when we needed some advice. And of course, that's why you get kind of gurus to the stars, you know, because if you're incredibly wealthy, I mean, you know, you're going to have somebody who does your hair and somebody who massages you. And why not have a guru too, so that when you're under stress, you can talk to them. So it's definitely an archetype. But as well, there are suggestions about who he might have been in history.
Is there a difference between, since you brought up women, and we're talking with Philip Carr Gom of the Book of English Magic, is there a difference in the way, is there a sexism inherent in English magic? Has the magic of women, the crone, or, you know, the woman on the outskirts of town, is there a difference between the way in which wizards have been treated and witches have been treated?
Sure. Well, that touches on one of the divisions of which is high and low magic. High magic has been a kind of an art practiced by members of the aristocracy, by intellectuals, historically usually men, although there's some interesting examples of women that we brought out in the book, outstanding women, but it's tended to, for historical reasons, to be mainly men. They've been engaged in magic as a kind of study of higher things and of personal and spiritual transformation generally.
Who's that? Women have
low magic. Sorry?
Are you saying women have? Did I understand that? The separation?
This has mainly been the activity of men for historical reasons, because men have been in a more privileged position.
That's what I understand. Okay. And that women have been more commonly associated with the lower forms of magic.
With the low, practical magic, where they're dealing with healing, with curing people, sorting out practical everyday problems. And so you have the whole business of witchcraft, which then has developed into Wicca in the last 100 years or 50 years. Then that has tended to be women. Of course, women tend to be more practical. It's kind of interesting, isn't it? It's women, on the whole, tend to be concerned with, looking after the kids, being more practical. Men have their head in the clouds and so on.
Is that so much true, or just the fact that, as you say, practical magic is a woman wouldn't be able to take the time to put her head in the clouds and think about other things until she could get the baby to sleep?
Absolutely. Yeah. Being concerned for people's health and so on. And, of course, then when it goes wrong, it's kind of easy to understand in a way how you got that at some level. You've got the old woman on the corner of the village who's a bit weird, but she's got this reputation for fixing you if you're ill. And you go and see her, and maybe you're slightly frightened of her, but she mixes up some herbs or whatever, and it cures you. Now imagine the times when it goes wrong, and the person the child is taken, but the child dies. She doesn't manage to heal the child. Then you can see how easy it is for people's feelings to turn, and suddenly this woman is evil, and she's killed my child, and so on.
Well, but at the same time, too, if it weren't for the women on the outskirts of town, or women passing along the wisdom, which often is perceived as having sort of this practical magic aspect to it, then you wouldn't, if the women didn't do it, we wouldn't to this day have old wives' tales, basic advice, things that you can learn, things like, ways to avoid getting ill, even the whole an apple a day keeps the doctor away, or ice cream leads to nightmares, or things which, just stuff that actually, in a lot of ways, for a lot of people, it really is practical and it really is true, but it does have a kind of magical thinking to it. I've always liked that about old wives' tales.
Absolutely. And I think, we're alive in a fabulous time now where a lot of the sexism has gone away. And in magic now, there are just as many women, if not more women, involved than men in all kinds of magic. So, for instance, in our order, we have about 12,000 members around the world, a lot in the States. And the gender distribution is probably 60% female, 40% male, something like that.
Now, as you mentioned, some of the prominent magicians that have been, or wizards that have been, part of the aristocracy and been involved in the formation of English history as we know it today. Are there any that are thought of as being like Rasputin? They were practitioners of a darker form of the arts?
No. Do you know something? That's kind of an interesting question. And I think the answer is no. My sense is that all those people actually were working for good. I mean, I've got a book open here that's just been published by the Prince of Wales. It's called Harmony, and you open the book, beautiful book, just come out, and he starts the book by saying, this is a call to revolution. So here's, you know, somebody right embedded in the aristocracy there. This is a call to revolution. The earth is under threat. It cannot cope with all that we demand of it. You know, revolution is a strong word, and I use it deliberately. And then he goes on to his philosophy, which is essentially a magical philosophy. He talks about sacred geometry. He's got pictures of Newgrange. I mean, this guy is fantastic. He understands. He has a spiritual, magical world view that's deeply, deeply spiritual and reverencing of kind of the golden thread in all religions. And he's linking it to the mess we've got ourselves into now and how we have to get back in touch with nature, which is another way of looking at magic. Is it's a way of opening to the magic of the natural world and saying, let's attune ourselves to nature and work with it instead of against it, trying to bend it to our will.
Would you be able to give us an example coming up of a simple form of magic that we, any of us who are uninitiated, might be able to use as, you know, sort of a lens into this bigger tradition of English magic?
Okay, so you want me to think of a little technique that listeners could apply that would kind of open them to
magic. The magical version of the potato and iodine experiment or something, you know, like any kid can do that, but you get a better understanding of what science is about. So is there something that would be accessible to us to do that might sort of broaden our view of what magical thinking means and how we could benefit from it? Or for that matter, for some people, not be terrified of it.
Yes, sure. Yes, I'll think about that. Now, after the break, I'll come back to you with that.
I'd love that. And, you know, we are talking about English magic, and I think the power of words is something that that came up a little earlier, that when you put spells down, so much of what we understand as being a spell, in my opinion, is really just the planting of a thought seed that begins to germinate in somebody else. And a lot of the darker side of this, the idea of putting a curse on somebody, is to get them to accept that their life is going to get bad. And so that no matter what happens to them, they end up thinking in somebody else's worldview. They allow somebody else to control the perception that they have of what's going on around them. And I think that should be pointed out, that sometimes it doesn't take much to get somebody to be a victim of magical thinking if they have no immunity to it, and somebody attempts to control their mind and how they're supposed to think about the events that are transpiring in their lives. What do you think of that?
Sure. I think we're, our minds are highly suggestible, and advertising is a kind of magic. But it's using the power of words and images, if it's on television, which are the two key tools of magic, which is vision and sound, and it's using it to influence people. So that kind of influencing is going on all the time. And you made a kind of connection with agriculture and magic there by talking about planting seeds. And I think that's very true. And once we realize that all the time, by what we say and the way we relate to people, we are actually sowing good seeds or bad seeds, magic then becomes an act of responsibility.
I like that. And that we too, then, even those of us who are not practitioners of magic, we should still be open to the idea of practicing some sort of defense against the dark arts, a way of being able to borrow a phrase from somebody else, stand porter at the door of thought and keep out other people's magic from getting into our head, so that we don't end up becoming an agent of something that is not part of our destiny. All right, well, hang on. We're going to try a little experiment here in just a second. Philip Kargam has promised to come up with a little piece of magic that we could try to see more about what it's like to be magical. The Book of English Magic next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. So hold on. Yeah, well, let's talk about this in just a second. You want to stand by? A little magic trick, a little bit of magical thinking for you to try to understand better the Book of English Magic. Just what about England is so magical, and why did so much of what we understand today as magic in the world originate on this tiny island? Next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. Philip Carr Gomm, the author of the Book of English Magic. No relation to Ian Gomm?
No, I don't think so. Well, maybe way back in the past, if two families, the Gomm family and the Carr family, came together in the 19th century. Maybe.
So I love the idea that just for people who are resistant to the idea of magic or only think about magic in terms of, you know, I Dream of Genie or Bewitched or even in some of these latter day TV incarnations where they feel like anything that is magic is satanic. Anything that any kind of magical thinking would be antithetical to a belief in the divine. Whereas that's not the Druidic belief, and that's certainly not the core of the Book of English Magic.
No, certainly not. I mean, many, you know, there are Druids who are Christians, there are Druids who are pagans, there are Druids who are Christians, there are Christian magicians, believe it or not.
No, that didn't surprise me, actually. No.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of people say the first magic act of all time was God saying, "Let there be light," and there was light.
Exactly. It's really about the shift from being reactive to the world, just acting out of fear, being frightened of things and reacting, to being proactive, to saying, I'm here for a reason, I'm trusting life, I'm trusting, you know, in a higher power and in my best self, and I'm going to be in the world and work from that perspective.
So take us through one quick thing, if you would, of what might be an experiment, not a spell or however you would define a magical introduction.
Okay, here's a little idea. You imagine you have a magical pair of glasses, and they are split. You know, they're split in, what are they called, bifocals. So, you know, where the bottom half of the glass gives you one perspective, you look up and it's, you know, long distance, short distance.
Okay. I'm wearing them right now. I am.
Okay. And you know, when you have a difficult encounter, say somebody is rude to you in a restaurant, or you know, you're having trouble with your spouse or whatever, we tend to be reactive. When somebody is aggressive towards us or there's a problem, we tend to be reactive and just to immediately only see that side of them. With this pair of magical spectacles, you're not being an idiot. When you put them on, you're still seeing that. One lens shows you this aspect. But the other lens, when you move your vision up, you see the divine part of them. You see them as a radiant, as a soul, as who they really are. And so this takes time. What happens is take an incident. I was in a restaurant in Berlin a couple of days ago, and there was some waitress who was, for some reason, she was obviously going through some problem, and she was kind of angry with me. And one's immediate reaction is to be reactive, to get angry back. But instead, if you just pause for a second, you put on your magical spectacles and you look through the other lens and you see that this person is a soul, the way they, and you smile at them and you're warm to them and you connect at that level with them. And then things change. You know. So this is kind of shifting us from being fear-based to taking a little time. There's this wonderful way in which Stephen Covey talks about responsibility being our ability to respond, that we have this moment, just this moment where we can take a pause. We don't have to be in a hurry, just can make a decision. And this is a decision to work out of a place of trust. So a lot of magical skills are, if you like, this kind of psychological ideas. If the idea of working with a pair of glasses doesn't, that's just a trick, if you like, or a device for you to use. You can do it without that, of course. You can just look directly into somebody's eyes and smile at them and kind of see their soul, you know, shining through even the angry part. And, you know, it makes a difference to how you experience the world.
I like that. And I would say, what's the difference between magical thinking and mystical thinking? Because I would identify what you just said as being part of the tradition of mysticism.
Ah, okay. Yeah, there's an interesting mysticism tends to be one way you characterize it, and they're two sides of the same coin. I think we need both. Mysticism is the desire to merge with the divine. So it's a question of letting go, of opening up, and of merging with the divine. And we just want to, the main impulse in mysticism is to merge with God, to be one with God or goddess. Magic is more proactive and says, I'm here on Earth for a reason. As well as merging with the divine, I'd also like to act in the world and to be a force for good myself.
Like that. And the for years, I mean, I think the only place that people, well, not the only place, but a common place for people to encounter this would be in the occult bookshops. And I like the fact that you included that in the early part of the book as a discussion about how even walking into an occult bookshop was its own kind of initiation into magic, just to see the titles, just to see the concepts that are being expressed, that in itself was, even before you had opened up and read one, the fact that they existed was kind of a paradigm shifter. And yet occult bookshops are also kind of disappearing, as many other bookshops are, because of the availability of all of this information and for the books themselves on the internet.
And
that seems sort of sad to me. Not that I spend any time in occult or, for that matter, adult bookshops. But I mean, there is something that's thinking again about Harry Potter, or thinking about some of these great scenes in movies where something like that can only happen, it seems, in a place like that with, you know, old wood shelves and some old wooden person behind the counter.
Absolutely. It's one of the sad things. In the UK, one independent bookstore closes every week. It's really a shame. There's nothing in it. You know, unfortunately, there doesn't seem to be much that we can do about that except adapt to the changing situation. And instead, what we have is we have the internet. We have, you know, mainstream bookstores having mind, body, spirit sections that we go into and can connect with books. And what we have to do, I think, is we have to adapt to this changing situation and kind of use our natural intuition. Our intuition knows when you surf the web and you look at subjects about magic and the occult and spirituality and all the rest of it, there's a kind of intuition we have that, no, that isn't my thing. You know, it just turns you off in some way. And another one turns you on, and you can track it. And I think provided you have a sense of, you know, coming from a place of good intentions and just wanting the best for yourself and the world, your intuition will guide you to the right kind of places, I think.
Do you enjoy the Harry Potter series?
Do you know, I'm really bad about reading fiction. I write nonfiction, and when you write nonfiction, you tend to have to read a lot of nonfiction in order to write it and research it. So I read about one novel a year or every 2 years.
That's about me. I about the same thing. But when my kids were younger, I had to, and I reread them, you know, in nightly installments, the Harry Potter series, probably up to like book 4. I was just curious in your perception then, anyway, whether that comes from the book or the movie or just from osmosis. What about the magic that's talked about in Harry Potter? What about that interests you?
Sorry, I missed the last part of that sentence.
What about that interests you when you see it? I know how kids are fascinated with the idea of being able to call upon power and to use that to push adults around. You know, I get the appeal to a 12-year-old on why they would want a magic wand or to be able to, you know, say Expelliarmus and be able to change the world around them. For younger people, they cleave to that sense of authority and power. But what about anything about the Harry Potter series interests you as the chief druid?
Sure. Well, of course, you know, that whole interest in magical fiction, and the other kind of intriguing thing is that a lot of the magical fiction has come out of England as well. It's not just the kind of the arts of magic, but magical fiction, you know, from Tolkien through to the whole Arthurian stories from earlier on through to C.S. Lewis and the whole Narnia series and J.K. Rowling, they came out of England as well, which is interesting. So what we do is actually, as we go through the book, we have little boxes where we suggest that you can read the history of England through fiction if you want to. Each period has a bunch of books that we recommend so you can read your way through the story of English magic. But the stuff around that J.K. Rowling talks about is, of course, what she's doing is she's she's opening us to the idea that life is much more than we thought it was, and that there are these kind of forces and realities and dimensions that exist that we can learn to connect with and to work with, which is the whole kind of interest that magic has, I think, is that the world is much more exciting than we imagine. And, you know, one of the interesting things about her is that, you know, she talks about how she would, how she's learned a ridiculous amount of alchemy, and how she's not drawn to being a witch, but she would be quite interested in being an alchemist. And one of the things that we discovered when we were researching the book is how much a particular Rosicrucian work, The Alchemical Wedding of Christian Rosenkreutz, had actually influenced her work, whether unconsciously, whether she read it one day and some of the ideas sank in and then reemerged, or whether consciously she actually created the Harry Potter books to somehow be conveying some of this this imagery of the alchemical wedding. But nevertheless, it's her idea that you know, alchemy, the core idea of alchemical magic, is that you can change. Something that's dark and difficult can be changed with the right kind of application into something radiant and bright. And that's, you know, I believe what's at the heart of Harry Potter and is at the heart of alchemy as well.
In your list of British authors who have written about English magic, do you include Ian Fleming?
Has he written about magic? I remember the tarot deck in one of the movies that takes place in Haiti.
Live and Let Die, I think, in New Orleans and stuff. No, actually, I think that I've heard the argument made that Ian Fleming, James Bond in particular, is actually a magical kind of character, that if you look at it just in terms of the overall the story of James Bond, he's a larger than life character. He has all of the seemingly magical charisma, right? Yeah. I mean, he has the ability to fight and love at a level that mortals, you know, can only dream of. So he's sort of godlike already in his abilities. But then at the beginning of every story, at least as it's presented in the movie version, he gets magical devices. And it's sort of like how we think about like video games and stuff, where you got to, you know, you pick up this item in order to, or even like Lord of the Rings somehow, that at the beginning of every story, James Bond has these new magical devices, and you know at some point he's going to use them to thwart evil.
Yes, well, that's a really interesting point you make, because at the heart of magic, there's this key idea, which is the same idea that's in the human potential movement as well, and a lot of, you know, is that we are much more, you know, that our little egos, you know, personalities caught up in our own little problems. I mean, there's actually much more to us than that, and that is the magical self, the soul, the spirit, you know, whatever you want to call it, and that if you develop and refine that, you can actually do amazing things. And then the various tools, the magic wand, or it's very interesting, your ideas about James Bond, because 007 was a code name, you know, John Dee was involved in spying as well. And so there's a theory that Ian Fleming got the code name 007 from studying the life of Dr. John Dee in the Elizabethan times, which is when the British Secret Service was first developed.
I've heard that. I believe that to be true. And I think that may also be why James Bond is an archetype like Robin Hood or other characters that it really isn't about the Cold War. And when the Cold War ended, James Bond merely took a different form, much like, even though we don't really know or care who the Sheriff of Nottingham is, still he seems like some really important guy that we're supposed to want to beat. You know, all these years later, even though we have no connection to him whatsoever, we hate him, and we don't even know why.
Yeah, 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 absolutely, absolutely. You know, and this idea of being on a mission, you know, of having something, is something that's terribly appealing. And, of course, it can lead to all sorts of fantasies and silliness and all the rest of it. But, again, that's something that appeals about magic. But what if I have a secret mission? What if you and I had a secret mission? And part of that secret mission was that we would meet, in the year 2010, over the other sides of the planet, and we'd use some technical device to connect. We haven't met for thousands of years. We'll meet, and we'll spend 3 hours talking about magical ideas that will help people to change their lives and turn their lives around, that will reach thousands of people all around the world and so on.
Yeah.
I mean, you cast like a so-called normal event, like me doing a radio interview with you. You talk about it in a different way, and suddenly it becomes kind of extraordinary.
Yeah. I think the other piece, and then I'll put it to bed, on the idea of James Bond as a magician, is that when the devices that he's given at the beginning of the story are, of course, the devices that he will need in order to win. But even that is a kind of magical thinking, because you don't have – he's not given a device he can't use. It's not – if he has the laser beam, wristwatch, he'll need it. And he's never given a device at the beginning of the movie or the book, and you're going, wait, why couldn't he have used the – the boot knife, never came up. And so you wouldn't have things you don't need, but you always have the things that you do need. And that if we can look at our own life like that, that we have the tools we need all the time. We just have to use them at the right times.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's nice. That's nice.
Okay. So we're talking about the Book of English Magic. We'll get to your calls coming up for Philip Carr Gom in just a moment. What about things like that we associate so much with magic? Do you have a magic wand yourself?
Yes, I do. Yeah.
How do you choose your magic wand, or did your magic wand choose you?
Well, it chose me. It was given to me. One can make one's own. It can be given to you. There's a wonderful wand maker in the States who makes beautiful, beautiful wands, who's a member of our order. There's all sorts of ways it can happen. And of course, at the heart, the magic wand is a tool. It's an internal tool. It's an ability of the soul, if you like. The external wooden stick, it can be helpful when you're doing a ceremony or something like that. But what you really need to possess is that the ability that the magic wand represents, which is the ability to be focused, to be directive, to be powerful in a certain way.
What's the most powerful act of magic you yourself have ever perpetrated?
I don't know. I mean, I really don't know. But I'm aware of the fact that when I write books or when I make recordings, you mentioned earlier on that I'd written a book called Wild Wisdom. It's actually a downloadable set of meditations called Wild Wisdom. When I make a recording of the meditation, I'm aware that it's a magical act. But it's, sowing seeds, as you said earlier on. It's sowing seeds in the world. It's radiating light. And I hope that, that's been one of the most magical acts.
And yet, and that's lovely, have you've never made yourself disappear?
I'll have to think about that. Okay. I don't think so.
Well, don't do it now, because we got a bunch of people that want to talk to you. The phones are already lining up for Philip Carr Gom. He is a druid chief, or maybe that's a druid chef. I better check my writing here. And he'll take your calls, questions and comments about English magic, your questions about the Book of English Magic, or at least as you understand it, the tradition of English magic from whatever source material you draw from. And we'll get to that coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Ponet.